plate a potential nugget.
I think the other piece that really struck me when I was doing the research for this conversation, Venkat, was, you know, when you decided to move on from Eklavya, you did something totally out of the box. You encashed your savings and buy a 12-city pass to the US to take your parents there.
Actually happened while I was still in Eklavya. That was
okay.
Yeah, that was a good 6-7 months before I moved out.
Okay.
Actually, no, good 18 months before I moved out. Yeah.
Okay.
So this was 98 April.
Okay.
So Sridhar, Sudhir and I, you know, we were getting paid much less, but you know, Ahmedabad is a ridiculously low cost city in those days, and we all had very simple lifestyles, and we were working literally much more than 100 hours a week. I remember one of those days we saw an article that said that guys in Goldman Sachs are burning out because they have to work 80 to 100 hours a week. And so Sridhar, Sudhir and I, we sat and we calculated and we were actually working much more than 100 hours a week regularly, right? And so we had nothing. Work was our life. We used to do nothing. So we'd start early in the morning, we'd sleep at 2 in the morning, start again the next morning. Sundays used to be lighter because we had chores, but we would work 12 hours even on Sundays, right? So we were all consumed about our work, and it wasn't work. It was sheer joy for us, right? Thoroughly enjoying what we were doing. So there was really no kharcha. So basically, and you know, the good thing about Sunil Handa is he likes to take care of key people. So he was very worried about the fact that we were, you know, how do we help us build our own savings and stuff like that. So he convinced a friend of his, an architect, to, you know, identify 3 flats, and he said, okay, I'm going to actually book these flats for you guys, and you know, you pay me back this much per month over a 7-year period. Wow. And the house is yours. Nice 2 BHK flat in a very posh apartment complex in Ahmedabad. So we were all beginning to save up for that. And so that pretty much in 95 itself or so, we started doing that. And then I think 98 is when, very interesting, I was in Bombay meeting my parents or something. I was still in Ahmedabad. Reading the newspaper one morning, opened it, going through the classified. So we had put out an ad for admissions or for teachers, hiring teachers or something in the classified section. I was looking for my ad and I saw this little ad saying, you know, Bombay, New York, Bombay, Royal Jordanian, 23,000 round trip. I said, what? That's like ridiculously cheap, right? 23,000 for a round trip. And because I remember that in early 90s, when my brother had gone to the US, he had paid 40,000 for a one-way trip. It was like ridiculously cheap. I did the math. I had saved about 80,000 rupees towards that house. I'd paid 80K worth of installments towards the house. That's like, plus I had some savings of my own and stuff like that. So I kind of said, "Plus lakh rupees to kharcha kar sakte hain. Why not just, you know?" My brother had started working. 91, he had left home. This was 98. 7 years, my parents hadn't seen him. Very different world, right? In those days, you couldn't afford to fly back to India and stuff like that. You ask any parent in those generations, they didn't see their children for 10 years. It hit my mind that the easiest thing, you know, I had already shortchanged my parents financially by choosing this, you know, non-money-making kind of career. I kind of felt the least I could do was give them the joy of getting them to see their son. They hadn't seen for 7 years. So I said, chalo karte hain. So booked 3 tickets for all of us to go to the US. Flew them over to Cincinnati, which is where my brother used to live. And then I also got a ridiculously good thing called a VUSA fare, Visit USA fare, that used to exist in those days, where I got to travel to 13 cities for $460. In those days, the dollar used to be some 30 rupees, something like that. So that was again ridiculously cheap, 15,000-20,000 rupees. And I had a lot of friends living in different cities. So I just reached out to all of them, said, can I come and, you know, just stay, crash in your place for a couple of days? Most people said, yeah, sure, why not, etc. So I actually managed to, in 460 plus maybe another $50 or $100, travel to more than 12 cities for 40 days in the US.
Wow.
I think that was the best ROI. I was very, very curious about what the US is. So a lot of people say that traveling is a great way to learn, right? And I do believe in that. I don't, I'm sorry.
No problem.
I'm like, I'm not much of a tourist. I've been to Agra 3 times. I've never seen the Taj Mahal. I couldn't care about it. I'm not that social, you know, the literary, art, culture, that kind of a guy. But every city I've been to in my life, I've gone to the market street, looked at it. And I think I gain a lot more insights into how people are by looking at those places.
When it's, so when
I'm
it's
very
market,
keen to, sorry?
When you say market, what exactly?
Marketplace, the bazaar,
street,
right? Okay. This thing of every city. So I think you learn a lot from there. Mm. You learn about, you know, how people behave, thought processes, all of those kind of stuff. And something in the back of my mind always was, you know, I had this question of what makes the US tick as a country. I was very, very keen to go. So I got a chance. So I said, "Bas ghar var bana ke kya karna hai?" I was very clear I was going to stay single in life. I didn't need a house. I could stay in a rented place. My plan was at some point, if I shift back to Bombay, I'll stay with my parents. So I don't need a house. I went back to Sunil Nanda. I said, "Yaar, mera paisa wapas de do, ghar aap hi rakh lo." Took the money and did it. It was a great, great thing. I think easily the best investment I've made in my life, if you ask me. Mm. You know, I think your stocks and other things can give you 5-fold, 10-fold, whatever return.
Mm.
I think many of us need to realize that we, you know, that point about being a tool for society. I'm saying even if you're not as for society, even if you see yourself as a tool for your own good,
mm.
I mean, what is, you know, you build a house or whatever, what is your most productive asset in your life? It is yourself, right? It's your own brain, your own capabilities. And anything you can do to reinvest in yourself is going to give you the highest return on investment.
Mm.
And I think we look at it narrowly from point of view of doing courses and studying and all of that stuff. But I think you learn a lot through life, through exposure and through stuff like that. So I think that was easily the best investment I've made in my life.
Yeah.
You know, in hindsight, Give India wouldn't have existed if I hadn't done that investment.
The other thing you mentioned in the passing was the decision to stay single, Venkat. Was that an easy decision? Because that's a...
Very easy decision.
That has a profound implication on what, on the stuff that one can get.
Yeah, it dramatically simplifies life, right? The moment you choose to stay single, your costs come down, your liabilities come down. So it gives you an extraordinary amount of financial freedom,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't have to worry about having to earn enough all the time.
Mm.
You can't do anything about parents and family. You inherit that. You know, without them, you won't even exist. So that's a duty you owe back, and you need to do whatever you can. But why create more liabilities for yourself?
Mm.
So from the financial front, the other is emotional, right? I mean, like I told you, I'm going to see myself as negative emotional footprint. Why add more people to leave a negative emotional footprint on us? So, you know, some poor girls, some poor kids, why? Just no logic.
Got it. And back to Give India, where were the seeds of Give India sown? Were they sown in that US trip, Venkat?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's what I meant when I said that Give India probably wouldn't have existed if I hadn't done that US trip, right? So, a lot of things that happened in that US trip. One is, I was still running the school then, right? At Eclavit.
Right.
So, bulk of my trip was visiting schools in the US. So, every city I went to, I visited the public schools. I visited a couple of private schools also. But US had very, very few private schools in those days. And so, mostly it was public schools run by the government, stuff like that. And I, you know, I would have visited at least 30 or 40 schools over those 40 days. I don't remember even one school that I went to that did not have parents volunteering in them.
Mm.
And most of these, well, I was some lalu guy coming from the US. So it wasn't like from India. And, you know, in those days, people hadn't even heard of India, many of them in the US. So it wasn't like they were dressing up their school for me or something like that. Many of these cases, when I walked in and met the principal and say, "Hi, you remember I told you I'm going to come." Those were pre-email days when barely people had email and stuff like that. And many of them, "Oh yeah, I completely forgot. Okay, chalo," kind of thing. So they didn't even prepare for it. But I don't remember a single school where a parent wasn't volunteering, right? There were mothers helping, you know, the teacher with cutting out magazine images from magazines and stuff like that for the kids to do their project work. There were mothers working with the slow learning kids in the class so that the teacher can help the others. Mothers reading to the younger ones while the teacher did a play with the older kids. All of those kind of things, doing a bake scale to raise money for the kids to go for a science project somewhere or a museum visit or stuff like that.
Mm.
So it was really amazing to see how much people cared.
Mm.
The like when we first landed, we spent a day sightseeing in New York. Worst day I had, waiting 8 hours in a queue to see Statue of Liberty. It's the most useless thing I did in my life, but my parents wanted to see it. They think it was one of the greatest days in their life. And then immediately after that, we went actually to Cincinnati, which is where my brother used to stay. And we were there for about 4 or 5 days before I moved out onto my trip. And then my parents stayed with him for a while and all of that stuff, right? So so in that place where he stayed, Dayton, Cincinnati, it's a Twin City kind of a thing. He was living in a community which used to have a newsletter. And very interesting thing, I had nothing to do at home. We didn't have a computer in the house or anything like that. So I was just reading all the stuff. There was a very interesting article I read or an ad kind of thing in that community newsletter, which said that, you know, many of you must be first-time mothers whose kids are going to go to school in August when the schools reopen. You might be scared about it. So there's a community of us mothers whose kids have already been to school, and we're going to offer a free workshop for you on how to get prepared for your kid to go to school. I just read that and said, what a wonderful thing to even think of. ऐसा सोचते भी नहीं है हमारे यहाँ, right? दूर दूर तक नहीं सोचते. So that had a huge influence. I mean, whether it's that, whether it's seeing the parents volunteering in every single school that I visited, the only parent volunteering back in my own school in India was a parent who had come back from the US. And you know, so that also was playing in the mind. Then I visited a place called Burlington in Vermont, up there north, where I actually didn't have any friends. So I was the principal, actually she was the district school superintendent, the lady I reached out to, elderly lady, and she actually offered for me to stay in her house. And so I went into a complete stranger's house and stayed in her house for a night. And she took me for a school district meeting. So there was a meeting happening where the parents had been invited. And so Burlington was going through a very funny situation. They had three schools, high schools, and they had to shut down one of them because they didn't have enough students. So the meeting was to discuss which school to shut down, right? And one of the most incredible things that happened is that some of the well-to-do parents who were there actually stood up and said, you know, there were people from the black community, you could see they were not so well off and stuff like that. The well-to-do people actually stood up and said, please close down the school near our homes because we all have cars, we can afford to drop our kids, but these guys cannot afford to. And, you know, that really hit me because, you know, we took the flight from Bombay to New York. So I'd come back home for that from Ahmedabad. And the previous days, Times of India in Bombay had a very interesting article about, you know, how there was a massive water scarcity in, you know, Virar, Mira Road and the distant suburbs of Bombay. And the ridiculous thing is that's where all the lakes are, right? So we are taking their water and piping it to Malabar Hill for the bureaucrats and the rich people of the city. And here I'm, you know, just look at the stark contrast of it. We live in a society here which is so selfish that we are stealing other people's water, leaving them in scarcity without water. Unka pani hum chori kar rahe hain. And here is a community which is saying, you know, don't worry, close the school near us. We can ship our kids further. I said, boss, ye ho kya raha hai? How do you... That was a thought. And then after I finished all my trips, my return flight was back in New York. So I came back to New York and I was reading the newspaper, the New York Times, and there was an editorial. Clinton was about to run for re-election at that point of time, I think, for a second term. A scathing article in New York Times or Wall Street Journal, I don't know which of those two, that Clinton's salary, the president's salary in the US used to be $210,000 a year then. And Clinton had donated $45,000 the previous year. So the article was critical, saying he gave only $45,000. And I was like hit by saying, which Indian will ever do that? So, you know, I came back, I was still running a school. So, I mean, I came back pretty much with a lot of other learnings around education and all of that. So that pretty much predominated my mind. But when we came back, you know, we were running a school where we were also bringing in a lot of underprivileged kids into the school. And we were just trying to build a cross-subsidy model, but we hadn't reached the scale yet of even being self-sustainable, forget cross-subsidizing. So we actually reached out to a bunch of people. A lot of people started sponsoring a child's education in the school. stuff like that. And in fact, because we were in education, Sridhar and I and Sudhir, a lot of our batchmates who were beginning to do well started reaching out to us saying, you know, I want to help somebody. Can you tell me which is a good organization? Kind of assuming that therefore we should know all the NGOs in India. Mm-hmm. So these things were lying at the back of our minds. I must be very honest, the 24th November, the day I quit Eklavya, I had no clue what I was going to do next. Just decided to move on. And then, you know, my brother had reached out to me. He had started doing well. So he sent me some, you know, I think $1,000 or something that he wanted to donate. And so I started researching what to donate it for and, you know, came up with a couple of good organizations, gave the money there. And so it hit me, all these things kind of coalesced together. It wasn't like serendipity, as Sridhar Sitaram calls it.
Maybe if I may pick up on that, Venkat, this notion of quitting without what next in sight requires a certain mindset. Can you talk a little bit about the point in time where you decided to quit with no clear vision of what next?
So I think post Eklavya, starting with Eklavya, whenever I quit something now, I will always quit without knowing what next.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it makes sense to give 100% to whatever you are in.
But what was it?
The last possible moment that you can.
But what led you to saying, I need to move on from Eklavya? What was brewing?
Well, the trigger was basically a slight, you know, difference of view on how we wanted to run the school and stuff like that. But that was just one of the triggers, I guess. So the other was, of course, this point about impact that I mentioned earlier, right?
Understood.
So I moved out, and Sridhar had not yet moved out. Sridhar still had to finish the academic year. So it was going to be clear that he was going to be stuck for at least another 6-7 months. I couldn't just sit idle and do nothing. So all these things started coalescing in the brain and put together an idea saying, you know, what about this revisit to the US trip in the head saying, you know, can we build a culture of giving India like that? Like the Americans are. And I started looking into, that's when I first started researching online. I just bought a computer at that time. So I used to spend my whole day doing research or playing bridge online on Yahoo Bridge. It used to be exciting in those days that, you know, your four of you are playing a round of bridge. One guy is from Dominica, another guy is from Turkey, third person is from some other part of the world, kind of thing. It's really fascinating. Yeah, so I just started doing a lot of research. That's when I started getting a lot of information around it, right? So how much does the US as a country give? $188 billion that time, 2000, which was 1.9% of their GDP in those days. Then I did research. We had no data on giving in India, but whatever little data led me to get a conclusion that we were at 0.1% of GDP. And that, you know, anecdotally, we all knew it, but there was some data pointing towards the fact that we were...
This is philanthropy or philanthropy plus CSR?
CSR didn't exist in India in 2000. Negligible.
Mm.
So it was like a very surprising thing. And then that thought grew, ki yaar, ye 0.1 ko agar hum 0.5% bhi kar denge, toh bahut badi cheez hai. It's, you know, it's worth spending a lot of time on. Mm. And for me, giving was not about the money ever. It still never is. I don't think the money that you give. So let's suppose you do make it even 2% of GDP.
Mm.
It's nothing, right? The government of India's taxes are close to 12% of GDP now. Mm. And if that 12% of GDP is not getting spent well, and that is meant to uplift the state of society, 2% se kya farak pad jane wala? I think it's all about how that 2% gets used that's going to make a difference. And the belief was very clear that if people care for the society, then you will have a much happier society. Belief is definitely not about how much money you raise, but how many people's consciences can we touch? Mm. How many people can we reach and make them feel that this is my country and I need to do something back for it?
And I think picking up on that, Venkat, a lot of the philanthropy often ends up being event-based, right? I think as I was doing the research, you speak about raising close to 1 crore in a week when Gujarat earthquake happened. But you say that the following year, you raised only 25 lakhs.
11 lakhs, yes.
11 lakhs. 3. Wow. So I'm curious about what you've learned about moving people from responding piecemeal when there's an event to instituting a culture of giving as a way of life.
I don't see the two as incompatible.
Neither or.
It's not neither or. In fact, actually with disasters, there is a bit of an issue. I think COVID is a huge exception to this. But otherwise, from my experience with the Gujarat earthquake, the tsunami, the Orissa cyclone and stuff like that, if it were up to me, I actually wouldn't mind putting a full page ad in the papers a day after the disaster, saying please do not give. However counterintuitive it sounds, because actually disasters create far greater supply of money than the need is. I've seen it firsthand. Gujarat, after the earthquake, we were helping people rebuild their homes, and we would go to people and say, here is the rubble, you help clear it off and we'll pay you to, we'll give you the materials to help build your home and stuff like that. And people used to say, no, but XYZ NGO has told me they will pay me 90 rupees a day to clear my own rubble. How much will you pay? Right? So it's money is an oversupply. There's a joke going around that if you really want to make money, wherever there's a disaster, go and set up a 3-star hotel. You'll make shitloads of money. Everybody will want to come and descend there to sleep. You make a lot of money out of selling hotel rooms. Disasters are normally like that. COVID is a huge exception to that. Variety of reasons, one of which it's not a short disaster, it's a protracted long one. And it's also impacted everybody. So it's not invoking just sympathy ki wo bechara, but it is, it could well happen to me tomorrow and therefore
right
much
from
more
the, right from an empathy the space than to, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. So COVID is definitely a huge exception to that, and we can talk more about it later. But yeah, I think the larger thought has been, how do we get people to care about society? The giving journey earlier and the volunteering journey now are both about the same at the end of the day. It's about how do we get people to care more about society? So you look at the amount of sacrifice people made during the independence struggle, right? I can't imagine us going through that right now. If you had to, as a country, decide that let's boycott Chinese goods, I don't think even the fans of BJP will do it. Forget anybody else. I'm saying, even if you're a deep believer in Narendra Modi, you're unlikely to have the willingness to pay the personal price of not buying Chinese goods. Right? Fundamentally a selfish society in that sense. Self-interest tends to dominate. And I think it's only if you learn to care about others that you can actually build a happy society. Otherwise, as long as you're only looking out for yourself, it's not going to change.
The big takeaway for me here was around how we think of ourselves and our assets at various points in time. Very often, we just look at the financial assets and miss out on some of the non-financial ones. And this reminds me of my conversation with Professor Linda Grattan, the author of the book 100 Your Life, who speaks about how we can stay relevant over a prolonged period of time.
Well, as you know, in the book, we talked about three types of intangible assets. We talked about productive assets, vitality assets, and transformation assets. And I think really, in your 40s, the productive assets become really important because you need to keep on learning. You need to keep on building new skills. You need to be saying to yourself and to the labour market, I'm still somebody who's got a lot to offer from now until the age of 70. So that's really crucial. But also, of course, transformational assets. And those are, as we said earlier, transformational assets are a lot to do with your network. So if at 40 you find yourself spending all your time with people just like you, then that's not going to help you to transform. So you should be looking around and asking yourself, am I spending time with people who are different from me in terms of their nationality or their mindset or their age or their gender? Because in that diversity, you can begin to imagine what your possible selves are. I think 40 is a good time to think about possible selves.
I do think looking at our assets in a holistic sense can make a big difference in terms of how we think about choices and where we choose to invest.